Hello, everyone, and welcome back to yet another episode of the Official Positions Podcast, where all positions are official no matter what you hear. First of all, I am excited to say that this episode is brought to you by the Conch Republic of Southern Florida. Blessed be the Conch. So it's great to be back and recording another episode. It's been a little while as compared to what I had planned originally to do roughly every 2 weeks or so, but in my defense, I had a little bit of some events happened, and I'm actually very happy to sort of reintroduce myself here on the podcast as Dr. Davis Ellison. Last week, as of time of recording now, I defended my PhD thesis, so I get to say I passed, and I get to be doctor now. Anyway, enough of that. I'm happy to be back, happy to be recording again and talking about some the things that at least interest me and I hope interest all of you at least a little bit. I had a little bit of trouble coming up with a title for this episode, so I just sort of went with the first thing that came to mind, and I'm calling it Decolonizing Your Reading List. So in perfect, just now officially in academic fashion, I'm going to be spouting off about books here for a little while and sort of my own experience with them, about university reading lists and how that has changed and evolved over time for myself, and hopefully give a couple tips out there to people who might be interested. So as I've mentioned in a couple of my other episodes, some of this is going to be generalized from my own experience. I at least have a bit of a mixed background of, political science, now war studies. So there's a lot that goes in there, and I don't want to be too harsh on, everyone in the field, because I've had some really great professors over the years and some great researchers that I've met who go against the grain and are actually doing a lot to counterbalance a lot of the trends and underpinning problems in a lot of the reading that we do all the time. But most of this is going to speak to sort of the generalized studying IR, political science, maybe, global history approach that probably the average person goes through, if you don't go through postgraduate studies or go on to do, get to the extent where you're doing some sort of critical studies, which the vast majority of people do not. So hopefully this inspires a little bit of thinking about what we're reading and doing. So getting right into it, the topic of decolonizing the reading list. So I'm going to start a little bit with some great sources that I've picked up on and had recommended to me over the years, kind of calling it the knowing the enemy recommendations. These are people who've written some great pieces of work that sort of criticize the literature that we're all used to and familiar with, whether it's international relations or history. So the first one I want to point out is a great book called Empires Without Imperialism by Jean Moorfield. First, I'm going to put all these, everything I'm going to say, I'm going to put in the show notes too, so you don't have to go digging around too much. Empires Without Imperialism, it's a great book that talks about, primarily centered around four authors, two much further in the past, but two more recently, where Jean Moorfield is going over their work to show how they write about the concept of empire without necessary, basically whitewashing the negative connotations of imperialism, which of course sounds like a complete oxymoron. And of course she's pointing out, and is a big contradiction in their work. And two people that she points out in particular are people that some of you might be familiar with. The first is a Scottish author named Neil Ferguson, and another, a Canadian named Michael Ignatieff. Two people who were very prominent in the early 2000s especially, but they are certainly still around. And both of them have very effectively made careers out of basically being apologists, both for British and American empire. Neil Ferguson being a particularly strong example there in his book, literally just called Empire. Moorfield is pointing out, but if anyone is actually reading the book, and I actually can imagine quite a few people have come across his work in other areas, he's written quite a lot, but maybe come across his book Empire, that sort of, it doesn't exactly avoid some of the things that, you know, the British Empire did, but it uses sort of the same logical twist that some, you'll even hear genocide deniers use sometimes, where it's like, yeah, sure, you know, some bad things happened, there was a few nasty people, but in the end, everything worked out and it was fine, and if anybody died, they probably deserved it anyway, kind of logic. So that's what Moorfield is really pointing out. But where that starts sort of compounding on top of what's already been done, you know, sort of the abuse of history by Ferguson, is a application of the same style of logic and thinking to the United States. He was a big supporter of the Iraq War, the War on Terror in general, sort of a big believer in this idea of an American civilizing mission around the world. So that's the first work she points out. The second one that she covers amongst the other cases in her book is Michael Ignatieff, and he wrote this famous article called, you know, America is an Empire, Get Used to It. And it's basically, you don't get to push back on what the U.S. says anymore. You know, they're in charge, get over it. And he's seriously not kidding, and it's actually sort of a perfect encapsulation of a lot of the thinking in the early 2000s. And you certainly see some people who still sort of spout off with those ideas today. So highly, highly recommend Gene's book. The second one, a bit similar, I'd actually almost put them right next to each other on a bookshelf, is How to Hide an Empire by another historian named Daniel Immerwahr, this time more explicitly focused on the United States. Another great one that unpacks a lot of the common histories and misnomers about specifically the U.S. And he sort of revisits U.S. history, not only in sort of a theoretical imperial sense, but in a literal sense of, you know, recasting the colonization of the U.S. as just straight up imperialism across the continent, and then coupled in the late 1800s. With the expansion to target Caribbean islands, and then in the Pacific with places like the Philippines especially. And he sort of focuses on all these different cases where he talks about, you know, how Hawaii and Alaska got colonized, how Puerto Rico, Guam, all the U.S. territories are still effectively colonized today. But the useful point of the book that I'm making, I don't want to over-summarize here, is that he engages really critically with a lot of the historical literature that has, again, effectively whitewashed this and sort of put everything that's happened in U.S. history in sort of a best intentions kind of limelight. And that goes right into the third one of the sort of Know Your Enemy class of books that I have, of The Atlantic Realists by a guy named Matthew Spector. Sure, some people I've talked to in person will say I've not shut up about this thing, but it's genuinely fantastic. It is a intellectual history of IR realism and how deeply embedded it is in these late 19th century writers who were effectively just coming up with justifications for why we get to conquer the globe. And it gets into all the, you know, there's so much in the IR literature that's still based in these assumptions of world ordering and cultural and racial hierarchies that have not, if they've been covered over, they've barely been covered over. So he does this great job of tracing that all the way through the 1890s up until really sort of the first half of the Cold War, where IR as an academic discipline really took off, where you have authors like Hans Morgenthau, Kenneth Waltz, Edmund Walsh, sort of building the realist foundation for U.S. empire and escalating the Cold War in the 1950s. So again, engages very critically with the academic literature and puts the literature itself, puts academia itself in those corners, into the service of empire, And he draws it. I had never heard of almost any of this before. And some of the most troubling ones are, of course, when this starts getting into the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, where you really start to see where some of the most important foundational pieces of thinking of realism and IR comes basically straight out of Nazi thinking. The concept of Lebensraum and spheres of influence, of Machtpolitik. He makes this great point that, you know, people that either sometimes discussions around realism gets reduced to this debate about Realpolitik, but he sort of says that's a red herring and points out that, you know, going back and looking at the sort of real source material of this thinking, it's more about Machtpolitik, you know, might makes right. You know, if it's not about military power, then it's not about anything style of thinking. That I think probably some of us who've taken IR courses before can at least recognize it, if not recognize the criticisms of it. So those are three great places to start in terms of starting to unpack and sort of flexing the critical muscles and becoming a little bit more familiar with the sort of roadmap of the intellectual history that we have. And then, you know, just expanding a little bit, you know, we've already identified some of the culprits of the sort of colonial reading list that we're used to hearing. Neil Ferguson, Michael Ignatieff. But I'll go into a couple others that I've come across. One that really comes to mind is a writer named Robert Kaplan. I'm sure some of you have heard of him before. You know, Kaplan, who's this sort of he's not a professor anywhere. He's just sort of this long, you know, widely traveled writer who many, many of his works have been, quite controversial and criticized by many in scholarship, but he's very widely read and more cited than probably most of us will probably ever hope to be in our careers. And, you know, one of the books that was very controversial at one point, especially in the 90s, was a book called Balkan Ghosts. Which was actually quite influential with the Clinton administration, where he argues that based on, again, some of his just travels through the region, that the inter-ethnic tensions in the Balkans are and always have been these sort of centuries, if not millennia-long hatreds that are completely unsolvable and just baked into the DNA of the people that live there at this point. And some have argued that that assumption that he argued for about in the book was actually contributing to the U.S. administration's policy of not intervening for quite some years as the conflict continued to spiral. But he's certainly not stopped. And the one piece of work I really wanted to point out is he has this collection of essays that I remember reading actually right in between finishing my master's and going to work at NATO, called The Return of Marco Polo's World, where he was sort of writing broadly about the Middle East, the various wars that had been going on at the time of writing, especially a lot of on Iraq and Afghanistan. And it wound up being a very strange combination of things of justifying the Iraq war, relitigating some of the lies of the Bush administration at the time, but even justifying the... There was this insane couple of paragraphs that in this one essay that was talking about Vietnam that was effectively trying to sort of hand-wave the My Lai massacre in 1968, which, if you don't know, was a massacre by American troops in southern Vietnam, of about 500 or so civilians in this couple of village hamlets there. And I just remember reading it and, you know, having to flip back and forth between the pages at the time. And this is when I was still a little bit hawkish in my thinking. And I was like, oh man, this is even a lot for me right now. So he's definitely one of the other great examples. One other that I'll point out is Melvin Loeffler. He is another historian. He has written many, many books about the Cold War, where he very much plays up the narrative of this grand clash between good and evil, between the United States and the Soviet Union, and everything else is effectively subordinated to that. It's very laudatory of the Reagan administration, and again, sort of downplays Iran-Contra and you know, other elements going on in Central America at the time under that administration, amongst other places. So he was an interesting one. And actually, one other that I have on the list here is a Brit this time again, coming full circle. Guy I was actually at a conference with, his name is Nigel Bigger. He is actually an Anglican priest and historian in the UK. And this will sound darkly funny based off of what I'm going to tell you about his views. He actually just received a life peerage and is now a member of the House of Lords in the UK. So he is right in the heart of British, you know, political social life in London at this stage. So he wrote this book called Colonialism, A Moral Reckoning. It came out about 2 years ago, and it was so sort of heinous that actually, I can't remember if it was either Penguin or Bloomsbury Press, effectively refused to run with it. And it comes all the way full circle to sort of Niall Ferguson's arguments about the British Empire, saying that it was all really justified when in the end, you know, on balance, the British Empire was more moral than any other empire out there. And of course, again, roundly criticized by just about every serious thinking historian of the British Empire, even ones who might be a little less critical, by simply, you know, refusing to include certain facts, you know, various massacres, whether it's the East India Company, whether it's British troops in North Africa, various points, downplaying the transatlantic slave trade, so on and so forth. But what are the two things that sort of I notice when I look across all of these sort of colonists of the reading list are two real themes that I think are quite common. One is, and this impacts the second, is they all are generally historians, or at least political scientists who write with a strong historical empirical basis, who are sort of subverting the work of the history they're writing to a broader project. Not even argument. Of course, every historical work has an argument, but a broader project of wanting to portray a certain political and ideological system surrounding either empires or individual countries. And that is effectively whitewashing. They want to, there, it's a very deliberate effort to try to say that, you know, no matter what may have been done or may not have been done, it was all worth it and all good. And of course, if it's not us, it's going to be someone else who's worse, and all the typical justifications for behavior that we're used to hearing. So that's the first theme that's quite prevalent throughout all of them. And then the second one is, across every single one of them, is this bending over backwards effort to try to portray good faith on the part of people who are doing things in the historical cases that they're covering. Now, of course, there are plenty of examples in imperial history where we can look back where people might have had some sort of good faith in their brain while they were doing something, whether that's, you know, forcing basically slave laborers into mines somewhere in any of the various national empires anywhere in the world, or conducting a massacre, or just undermining an area's sovereignty in favor of, you know, the Union Jack or the tricolor or whatever you say. There were people who did that with sort of this civilizing point in mind, and maybe they thought they had good intentions, but of course those good intentions were obviously completely colored by all of the bad intentions underlying them, namely control and destroying other people. But then of course there are the people who actually had actively bad intentions, actively genocidal intentions across imperial history. And you see people across these sort of apologetic histories making no bones about defending those kinds of people and their motivations. You know, of course, you have the outright imperialist ones who are denying genocide in some cases, but even a little less extreme, again, back to the case of Melvin Loeffler in Iraq, you know, he essentially, an argument of his book is that the criticisms of the Bush administration as being a bad actor in invading Iraq are wrong, and that they were all thinking they were doing the right thing, and that this was all actually in the core to help and liberate the Iraqis, and what would we rather prefer, have Saddam Hussein still in power? And again, this was something that many of us, this was a narrative that many of us grew up with for a long time and were quite familiar with. But now we know enough historical information to see that, in fact, there were bad faith actors within the Bush administration. There were people lying about intelligence. There were people lying for economic benefit. Of course, it wasn't for one monolithic reason. There was a combination of sort of delusional reasons and bad faith reasons, but it certainly wasn't any sort of good liberatory faith, you know, thinking that was happening in the administration. So these are sort of the, you know, colonists on your bookshelf that you probably have seen on some of your reading lists over the years, and already a couple of people that have criticized them quite roundly. So how do we start decolonizing the bookshelf? So I'll really just talk about some of the most influential pieces for me and just give, you know, a little brief overview of each of them. It's not a super long list, but one that's maybe familiar to people here in Europe, especially here in the Northwestern Europe, are all the works by David von Reybrouck, a Belgian, originally journalist, but now effectively historian because of his works. He had two books, one on Congo and one on Indonesia. The one on Congo is just called Congo, and the one on Indonesia is called Revolusi. Both were absolutely huge eye-openers. These were not topics I had ever learned about in any of my political science or history courses up until that point. The first being about the Belgian colonization and exploitation of Congo. And the second being about the Netherlands colonization, exploitation of Indonesia, and then ultimately the Indonesian Revolution. So both of them, you know, were big eye-openers in that it just added history that I had never heard before. But and they both works put them in the context of modern global politics in such a way that I hadn't thought of before. And then a second one, still sort of keeping with actually the topic of Congo, it's a little bit older, is Adam Hochschild's King Leopold's Ghost, which again is an excellent one. You're seeing sort of a theme coming out of a lot of these books came from genocide studies, where he talks about King Leopold II's genocide in what was then the Congo Free State and then the Belgian Congo, and the absolute horrors that were there and how much that wound up connecting into other crimes in the 20th century. So von Reybrouck and Hochschild for sure. I already mentioned Immerwahr, Jean Moorfield, and Spector. Some of them are also just, you know, sort of the classic liberation literature that we're used to hearing about: Edward Said, Frantz Fanon, David Hobsbawm, Eric Hobsbawm, sorry. These are sort of 20th century historians, critics. Fanon was a doctor, psychologist specifically, who actually, you know, very much experienced French colonialism firsthand, and was in Algeria. Edward Said, of course, the British Palestinian writer, who, you know, really propagated a lot of the terms like settler colonialism to describe the Israeli project. And then Eric Hobsbawm, a very openly Marxist historian from the UK, reinterpreting a lot of the histories of British history, going all the way back to the feudal eras and bringing it up to modern days, a series of books. He actually wound up getting him surveilled by MI5 and Special Branch during the Cold War, very much seen as a subversive critical writer, which of course only makes me like him more at this stage. And one other, I just wanted to point it out, that was actually sort of a starting point on a lot of the journey. This is something I read back in high school. You know, I had a whole episode a while back about my sort of transformation over the years from being quite quite Republican, quite hawkish. So I was at that point in my high school life, and I was in my little Noblesville, Indiana Barnes & Noble bookstore, and I wound up picking out a book called Rise of the Warrior Cop. I have no idea why I originally picked this book out, but I wound up picking it up. And it was a book on the militarization of police in the United States. And this was about when I was also sort of starting to pick up on, you know, the Edward Snowden affair and, you know, sort of the attacks on civil liberties at the time that are still happening. And I read this book and I just kept getting angrier and angrier. And it was challenging so many narratives that I had about the war on terror and policing. Back to sort of the good faith versus bad faith thing, realizing how much bad faith there was out there in this sector, that it was actually sort of, you know, part of that turning point that I had roughly a decade, no, over a decade ago now, of turning more towards the belief system that I have now. So yeah, Rise of the Warrior Cop by this guy named Bradley Balko, who's also a journalist and covers police overreach and violence quite widely, and appears in documentaries and has written many other things. But I can hugely recommend that one. And it sort of places, blends the domestic and international in such a great way that I found so incredibly helpful at the time. And I'll close out with a few, some things that I've read very recently, two I'm actually still reading. The first is a book called Homeland by Richard Beck. Not unlike the Rise of the Warrior Cop book, it's about the transformation of American political and social culture after 9/11, and how we sort of all sort of collectively lost our fucking minds after 9/11 and started hunting people left and right, mass discrimination against Muslims and immigrants, and set the stage for multiple invasions. So much of what we're seeing under the Trump administration now was built over 20 years ago in the aftermath of 9/11. And it's just being more broadly applied now and more aggressively. So that one's been fantastic. I won't fully summarize it yet since I haven't finished it. So maybe in a future episode. And another one I read outside of the U.S. case is Uncivil War, a book by Cardiff University professor Hugh Bennett, and also, I should say, one of my PhD thesis examiners, about the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And it's a great historical work, very much based in archival work, which is very close to my own heart, showing the British military failures in Northern Ireland, and again, unpacking some of those narratives that have been so pervasive and replicated in other places like Iraq and Afghanistan of, well, it was all good faith people muddling through, and actually unpacking that is like, no, it was actually some pretty serious, foolish mistakes, interacting with a lot of racism and colonial thinking, and just downright stupidity in some places, contributing and leading up to the outbreak of the Troubles and ultimately to the escalation of them and events like Bloody Sunday and so on. So phenomenal book, and can really recommend that one. And I will close on one that I just finished. It's called One Day Everyone Will Have Been Against This by Omar El-Akkad. You might recognize that name if you read his novel In American War, another great one. Maybe I'll have a fiction episode coming up next, where he's just talking about the cultural and political moment we're in now, about connected to the Israeli genocide of Palestinians, and just what it's like to be a writer in this environment. You know, he was also a journalist in a past life. He's Egyptian, Canadian, and American, now originally from Egypt as a child, and just getting into all the weeds of what it is like to navigate the current moment as a public-facing writer in the face of strong elements in society that are either ambivalent about what's been happening in Gaza and the West Bank, or are actively downplaying it and outright engaging in genocide denial. And I just love the way that he sums things up, and he is arguing that essentially this isn't a real good faith debate to have. You know, you either think that it's a genocide going on and there's not, or there's not, and there's a not a bridge to be crossed there. And so from his perspective as a writer, he simply is sort of disengaged from some of the argument and just continued for advocacy, which is a point that I can really appreciate. And I would strongly recommend his, you know, he's very much on the front page of book reviews and very much available in bookstores now. So this is, like I said at the top, you know, spouting off about a lot of books I haven't liked, that I do like, that I'm reading now, that I strongly recommend for all of you to take a look at. Like I said, all the all the books I mentioned are going to be in the show notes here, both the good and the bad, and I look forward to continuing to engage with some of the ideas in them. I really want to come back on some of them, especially some of the connections between domestic policing and international military operations, I think is such an interesting topic. But I will go ahead and shut it down there. Thank you again so much for listening. I hope to have another episode sooner than I have in this latest one. And until next time, thank you very much. Bye.